Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Shawl against Martin and the consolidated case. Mrs. Gordon, I think you may proceed when you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, the principal question presented is whether a New York State family court judge violates the due process clause when he detains an accused juvenile delinquent after he has conducted a detention hearing and after he has found, based on facts and reasons elicited at that hearing, that there is a serious risk that the juvenile, if released, will commit a pretrial crime. When the judge acts in the premises, he relies on specific statutory authority, namely Section 320.53B of New York's Family Court Act, which is the statute involved in this appeal. The appeal is from the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, and it arises in a proceeding brought by detained juveniles for a class writ of habeas corpus and for a declaratory judgment. I will address Section 320.53B and related provisions of Article 3 initially, and I do so both to inform the Court about the procedural constraints that New York imposes on the judicial decision to detain an accused delinquent prior to trial, and to rebut at the same time several alleged deficiencies in this procedure, which were assigned to it in the opinions below and are noted by appellees. I will then turn to appellee's two principal arguments under Matthews versus Eldridge, namely that some crimes must be excluded from Section 325.2B, 3B, and that some guidelines for judicial decision-making must be added so that the statute would survive scrutiny under the Due Process Clause.
On which an adult offender, given all the same factors, could be detained before trial.
In New York, Your Honor.
Yes, in New York.
New York provides bail for adults and does not have a preventive detention statute. It has been noted, however, that New York's bail law generally does take at least some account of future crime in the community, if that's your point. Of course, Your Honor is aware that the District of Columbia itself does have a preventive detention statute, which was cert denied in United States versus Edwards, I believe it was the term before last, and we contend, that our statute is identical in all material respects to Edwards and accordingly would pass muster in the same manner. Appellees do make one other argument other than their Matthews argument, and that is that pretrial detention to prevent crime, as distinguished from pretrial detention to assure appearance at trial, is unconstitutional punishment, and we have addressed that argument in our reply brief at pages 1 through 11. Turning to the statute.
In your view, what constitutional limits are there on a state's authority to detain people who are not accused of any crime to prevent them from committing future crimes?
People who are accused of a crime to prevent them from committing crimes.
Who are not. Can you detain somebody if they are not?
No, Your Honor. You cannot detain somebody that has not been accused of
a
crime.
And if they have been accused of a crime, what constitutional limits are there, in your view?
We would suggest, Your Honor, that there are two separate constitutional limits. One is quite important and one you have heard a great deal about today, and that is the Fourth Amendment and probable cause. That is not quite while probable cause is noted by appellees in the course of their discussion, they have not really made a separate Fourth Amendment challenge.
Well, do
in
you
this case.
Think that's a requirement, probable cause?
I think that probable cause, in the sense of Gerstein, which we believe is met under this statute, and in the sense of New York's further requirement that there be an adversarial probable cause hearing for these juveniles, which the prosecution has the burden, that probable cause requirement is well met in this case. We do not suggest that an affirmative finding of probable cause must be present at the time of detention. In other words, it is sufficient in our view that it is provided and the child given an opportunity to negative it at the time of detention, and that it is thereafter found based on the prosecutor's burden. In other words, it need not be simultaneously affirmatively found.
Is there any other constitutional limitation?
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. And that arises from the existence of the detention, or perhaps if you want to call it conversely, the release statute itself. And that statute has a due process relation, in the same sense as any other statute that creates an interest in property or liberty would have a due process relation. And the appropriate test for that statute is the Matthews versus Eldridge test, and it involves both considerations of its permissibility under the due process clause and the appropriate measure of the process that is due, which is exactly the issue we address in this case, the principal issue we address in this case. Returning to the statutory scheme, I think it's significant that we note, first of all, who the person is or who the child is that's involved. And the juvenile, according to New York law, is the juvenile delinquent under New York law, is an individual who commits an act between the ages of 7 and 16, which, if done by an adult, would be a crime. Under Section 302.2 of the Family Court Act, the family court's jurisdiction is not quite so confined. A juvenile who has done that conduct within the 7 to 16 age range may be prosecuted in the family court until he is 20 if a designated felony is involved, or until he is 18 if another felony or misdemeanor is involved. A designated felony is, we provide a list of them for you at page 6 of our brief in the second footnote, and is essentially a list of crimes allocated by age, which permit a family court judge sitting at disposition, which is the analog of sentencing, to give an initial placement period of 3 to 5 years, which is somewhat higher than the 12 to 18 month initial placement period that is available for other crimes. The place at which, the proceeding at which detention may be considered is called an initial appearance. And if a child has been detained on an emergency basis by an admitting detention authority, who is represented here today by the New York City Department of Juvenile Justice, which is administered by appellant, if he's been admitted to such an agency on an emergency basis, this initial appearance, where detention may be considered, must be on the next court day and never more than 72 hours later. If the child has not been detained, in other words, he's been released by the police after his arrest, his initial appearance is within 10 days. And I call your attention to a new provision of the statute, noting parenthetically that this juvenile delinquency procedural code was recently amended and all the amendments became effective last July. And there are some differences between the new law and the old law, and this is one of the differences.
Is the probable cause standard the same?
Probable cause standard is exactly the same, Your Honor. And this one difference, however, the police, on releasing the child, must give him an appearance ticket. And the appearance ticket now must provide that in a designated felony, he must return to court within 72 hours, and in other cases, crimes charged, he must return within 14 days. This makes some difference in looking at the opinions below and in noting appellee's brief, because one of the assignments of error in this case was that somehow the police decision to release a child rather than to detain him or bring him directly to the court made, according to the district judge and appellees, the judge's decision, who was sitting in that court later, error because he decided to detain him. And the gap in time between the time the child was originally arrested and released and ultimately appeared in court and detained was pointed out as an inadequacy in the statute, although, of course, it relies on the police decision and not on the judge's decision. In any event, the new provision of the law now restricts the time when the child could possibly be on the street if the police arrest him.
Stronger reasons to apply this restraint on juveniles than on adults?
Absolutely. I don't know whether they're stronger, Your Honor. I think they're different. And essentially, they are as follows. Let us assume that a state has an interest, a preventing crime interest, which is universal. It applies to adults. It applies to juveniles. The state has, with respect to that juvenile, another interest, which I would submit to you it does not have, at least in the same form that it has with respect to the juvenile. And that is its child protective interest. It's concerned that a child at the formative stages of his life not be engaged in a series of criminal acts, lest that kind of antisocial behavior harm his normative development. And related to that he should not be engaged in those criminal acts lest he actually become physically harmed by them. Namely, a police officer shoots him. The liquor store that he's holding up, the owner, not realizing that he's only 14, thinking he's 18, acts immediately and harms him. New York has those interests in the child. In that sense, it has its parents' patriae interest.
You suggesting liquor store owners shoot people I think are 18 but not 14?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. The point I was trying to make was that the state has an interest in keeping the child harm-free. And while it may have some interest in that with respect to adults, it has a stronger interest with respect to the child. That's the only point. In addition, Your Honor, we would also say that the child's pretrial interest in liberty is not the same as an adult. The essence of being a child, of being an unemancipated minor, is dependence and custodial status. Obviously, an adult does not have an absolute right to freedom. That's certainly true. But he certainly has a higher right than the child, so that those interests in relation make what I would submit to you is a match in favor of the state interests in preventive detention, pretrial preventive detention for juveniles, which match might not turn out to be the same if one carried the analog to the adult, to adult pretrial crime.
The trouble is, if you've got a hardened criminal, you can deny him bail. But the infant doesn't get any benefit. He can be the most decent child who committed one mistake, and he goes.
No, Your Honor, not quite.
I said he could go.
Could go, right. It is true, under New York statute.
Well, why that difference? Why not give the child a chance, the same chance you give a grown person?
Well, it's equally true, Your Honor, that a first offender, if that's the point, who comes up for bail may be denied bail, at least in New York. That's true. Denied bail is a discretionary matter.
First offender may be denied bail,
except a misdemeanor. In New York, except
for petty larceny?
No.
Well, all
petty
right.
Larceny,
what
bail.
An infant can be held in jail for petty larceny, first offense.
That is correct.
That's a difference, isn't it? The difference?
That is correct, whether
on that one type hypothetical.
There's a further difference, which I think follows from my elaboration to the Chief Justice, and that is New York has a stronger interest, I think, in preventing that juvenile from committing any further crime than it perhaps has in the adult. The risk to the juvenile from committing that crime is higher than the adult charged with petty larceny. And perhaps more importantly,
that a juvenile in the average juvenile home is better off on not committing another crime and not learning how to commit another crime.
You mean
is not as conducive to good living as a home, is it?
Depends a lot, as our detention specialist said, and indeed the detention expert for the city at the trial below. It depends a lot on the home, Your Honor. If you're a child living on the streets, then perhaps any home is better, and that's not to suggest that there is anything wrong with the detention facilities that we have. I would call one other fact to your attention, Your Honor. When I say that a juvenile accused of petty larceny may be considered for detention, I say that advisedly because in the juvenile case histories that are presented to you by the appellees, there is at least two petty larcenists. None of them were first offenders, Your Honor. They had records of 7, 6, 5 prior contacts with the family court.
I do assume that in the city of New York, you have found at least one first offender.
Who was detained?
Well, are there any?
Not. These are appellees' exhibits. They were petitioners below. They offered them,
well,
and they
you
didn't
say
give
that
us
no,
one.
Well, how do you get the second offenders up there if you don't have any first one?
And what is the practice, if you know, with respect to first offenders? Are they detained
for shoplifting? First offenders are considered for detention. For any detention, there must be facts and reasons on the record that are developed at this hearing. If we look at these hearings, at least so far as we have them in the record, and we only have 34, we find not merely criminal the commission of a crime, but as appellee's witness below, their psychiatric witness below, Dr. Zinn testified, a pattern, associated characteristics. In other words, we find a child who is charged with committing a crime, who is also not being supervised at home, who, when he was arrested, lied to the police, who is a truant at school. In other words, you find a combination of associated characteristics, which are called a delinquent pattern. Now, we do not have in this record, and so far as we know from the information that we have, Chief Justice, we don't have a single petty larcenist detained. That's all we can say because the data is not assembled any other way, and appellees who were attempting to prove their point, I assume, in showing us that there were minor criminals who were detained who did not have records, did not provide us with that information. Just returning briefly to the statutory scheme. At this initial appearance, the juvenile has all due process rights that this court has heretofore elaborated. He is for a preliminary stage of a proceeding and indeed some others. He is present. He is represented by counsel. He has the right to remain silent. He has the right to oppose any information offered against him. And he has the right to offer information on his own behalf. The judge, if he comes to the detention decision at all, must pass through two release options, options for conditional and unconditional release, much like the federal bail statute. One must pass through some unconditional release options, much like the District of Columbia preventive detention statute, where the judge must also pass through some release options. Judge Quiñones, who is a family court judge and testified below for the state, indicated, I think, quite eloquently, exactly how a judge comes to this conclusion. And that is, he said, and this is a point of the application of the statute, Chief Justice, he starts with absolutely no detention. In other words, he starts essentially opposed to detention. If then facts and circumstances are developed at this hearing, then those facts and circumstances overcame or may overcome what Judge Quiñones called the strong presumption against detention.
I guess there are no statutory requirements in that regard under the New York scheme. Is that right? For what the judge has to consider?
No. There are no additional criteria, as appellees call them, or guidelines for decision making other than the standard itself, which is precise, serious
okay.
risk of pretrial crime.
What review is there of the family court decision to detain a juvenile?
The decision is reviewable by several routes, generally by writ. Now, appellees say that this really is a non-reviewable situation, omitting to point out that most of the appellate law with respect to juvenile delinquency has been made by the progress of these writs up through the courts, and that New York takes a relaxed or quite liberal view of the doctrine of capable of repetition yet evading review, and renders these decisions. Indeed, the New York State Court of Appeals decision, which upheld this very statute, was on a writ. And they omit one other thing. That in the juvenile case histories that they brought to bear and introduced as evidence, one, Tony Gomez, was released from pretrial detention by the writ that they suggest to you is not available. So there is a thoroughgoing review.
Does the New York court... Go ahead.
I just wanted to know, you said there were several mechanisms.
Yes. There is an appeal by permission to the appellate division. There are motions for reconsideration. And I believe...
What about the probable cause hearing? Won't that occur before anything else could happen? And it has to happen within 6 days, doesn't it?
Correct.
And that is reviewable. If probable cause isn't found, there's a release, isn't there?
That is correct.
And so what's really going to be reviewed in all these proceedings by a writ is the finding of probable cause, isn't it?
No.
Well, why? I would think by then, the probable cause hearing, by the time you can get a writ, the probable cause hearing will go on.
That's exactly what appellees are saying. They're saying, well, this is really non-reviewable because the issue of my detention becomes moot, not necessarily a probable cause, but at fact-finding when the child is arguably convicted, which in New York, if you're detained, proceeds very quickly.
Well, by the time you could get a writ, wouldn't the probable cause hearing have been held?
Yes, but the probable cause...
And then there would have been a release if there isn't probable cause.
Yes, Your Honor, but as I was indicating, these are two separate notions, one the Fourth Amendment notion, the other the detention standard. The fact that there was probable cause found would not necessarily mean that the detention was appropriate, that the pretrial detention was appropriate. But in any event, even if it were so construed...
But it would mean that it couldn't happen without probable cause.
Certainly, that's true. He certainly couldn't stay in without the probable cause hearing. But an affirmative finding of probable cause doesn't necessarily cure a bad detention. But the New York State courts...
It helps.
Yes, it does. The New York State courts have not viewed the detention issue as moot. Thus, we have in the Court of Appeals the very case we have before you.
When they review it, at least for all practical purposes, there already has been a finding of probable cause.
Yes. Okay. Yes. And often a fact-finding, a conviction.
Yes. Review it if there's been a conviction?
Yes.
Well, for what purpose?
To establish the appropriate detention law because it is
a
capable...
For the guidance
for
the future?
Pardon?
Because of the guidance for the future.
Right, exactly, for the guidance for the future and because it is an issue capable of repetition yet evading review. The child in People X. Rel. Wayburn versus Schiff was long convicted when the Court of Appeals decided the issue. I believe he was convicted. There are relatively few remaining minutes, and I would like to come to, I think we've at least touched upon, the first Matthews argument that appellees advance, which goes to this balancing of interest that I was elaborating for the Chief Justice before. We believe that there are at least, in addition to their failure to assess the second child protective interest that's involved in the statute, and their failure to note that there is a distinction between a juvenile's interest in pretrial liberty and an adult's interest in pretrial liberty, when appellees press this analysis, they get to a third error, which is perhaps the most pervasive. And that is, since they hypothecate that some group of crimes must be excluded from this preventive detention statute, and they characterize them as trivial crimes, but they never define what kinds of crimes they mean, their weighing of the state interest and the juvenile's interest in these purportedly, in these crimes that are to be excluded is in fact a false weighing. In other words, without knowing what kinds of crimes appellees have in mind, they never can assess the importance of the state's interest in including them in a detention standard, nor assess the juvenile's interest in pretrial liberty in excluding them from the standard, so that when they say that the juvenile's interest outweighs the state's interest, they really have not made the requisite comparison, or the one that Matthews requires. In addition, the suggestion that some group of crimes should be excluded from the statute turns out to be, on the testimony of their own witness, criminologist below, to yield a worse statute than the statute that's now on the books. It yields a worse statute because, as their witness testified, the more you qualify crimes, the more you require that somebody predict a specific crime, which you necessarily would have to do to exclude crimes, the worse your prediction becomes. In other words, your error rate increases with every adjectival modification and with every particularization. And indeed, the easiest thing to predict is the eventuation of crime and not particular crime.
Attorney General, may I ask this question?
Surely.
What do we do about the fact that both courts below found as a fact that the law was carried out with unfettered discretion by the family court judges, and they decided against you on due process grounds?
Well, that I don't find a problem with.
You do?
Because there was the question of law. It is a question of law. In other words, they did not find as a matter of fact that the law was administered on with unfettered discretion.
Well, they, if I may interrupt you again, it seemed to me that they concluded that whatever might be said under Gernstein against Pugh, which was a Fourth Amendment probable
right.
cause case,
right.
that under the 14th Amendment there were no standards, so that the family court judges, in their own unfettered discretion, determined when to detain these young people.
Well, let me turn to that argument and pick up with you and Justice O'Connor. And that is that we have said at the outset of this case, that it is not guidelines for decision-making that will make this statute constitutional. It is the facts and reasons requirement and the stenographic record which is the requirement that takes a standard and translates it to a particular case. And that is the standard here. In other words, the stenographic record and the facts and reasons requirement. We said that Kent versus the United States established that proposition, and we adhere to it. The converse proposition that appellees are arguing, namely, that guidelines for decision-making, as opposed to the facts and reasons requirement, somehow are the thing that makes the statute constitutional, finds no warrant in the law, and they cite us to no case which say that guidelines, whether administrative or quasi-judicially created in a legislative capacity of a judiciary body, are what make the law constitutional. There's no case like that. Now, I think if we follow in terms of logic exactly what results from guidelines as opposed to from facts and reasons, we have to conclude that what the court said in Kent, namely it's facts and reasons and not guidelines, that is the appropriate standard. And I point out the following. We cited in our opening brief the precatory nature of guidelines for bail decisions, both the federal bail statute and the New York bail statute. Appellees don't challenge us on that at all. They agree, apparently, that these are precatory. What is precatory, Your Honor, seems to me cannot possibly be constitutionally mandated. Second, the existence of guidelines in no way translates itself into the decision-making process. For example, if I were to take the 7 general considerations that Judge Quiñones testified were common in making these decisions and distribute them widely to every judge in every family court judge in New York State, I would nonetheless be unable by that distribution to guarantee that any judge would not write on his record, to use the classic law school example, the boy was wearing a red tie. In other words, the guidelines themselves don't make the judge do anything. Now, certainly, the facts and reasons requirement can result in an error here and there. But certainly that requirement, the translation of the standard to the record, is what protects the juvenile from unfettered discretion. Indeed, the guidelines allow exactly the same kind of subjective decision-making that appellees are arguing against because they don't force the judge to do anything. The facts and reasons requirement, in contrast, do. Now,
can you measure due process without guidelines?
What do you mean, Your Honor, guidelines? If I give you...
How can you, any kind of guideline, written, oral, don't you have to have guidelines to have due process?
I have to have a relatively certain standard.
Well, don't you have to have standard?
I have to have a standard, and I have a standard here.
What is the standard?
Risk, serious risk of pretrial crime. It is not suggested, at least appellees bring no authority.
Is that all?
That is, and in the context, we must understand, a post-arrest context where the conduct is regulable in and of itself. In other words, this is not...
And what else?
Is protection of the child a guide?
Protection of the child certainly is a guide. It is a state it is the state interest in the statute, and it does obviously guide the decision-making. But, for example, let me call your attention to one example. The Judiciary Act of 1789, Your Honor, had a provision in it that said, defendants accused shall be admitted to bail. That statute was constitutional, Your Honor, and that didn't have any more guidelines than that. Now, the Kent statute...
Do you want me to give you some cases where this court says, in due process, you do have to have guidelines? Do you need those?
Your Honor, the question is, what is...
You don't, do you?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor,
Do you know of any other case that the answer to the lack of due process is answered by that you don't need any guidelines?
To go to Matthews, Your Honor, to go to the weighing process and the risk of error analysis that Matthews requires, the risk of error analysis, I think, as I've been trying to point out to you, that the addition of guidelines in this case, just like the addition of precatory guidelines in a bail statute, no more make that risk of error analysis better or worse. In fact, they do almost nothing.
Put it this way. Does it help?
I don't know, especially in light of the fact that Judge Quiñones testified that there were common considerations, that the Second Circuit found that there were common considerations, and that appellees now concede at page 67 and pages 21 and 22 of their brief that there are common considerations that are used.
Your time has expired now, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Guggenheim.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. The issue in this case is an important one which permits the court to answer the question left open in In re Gault, whether the Constitution has a role to play in protecting juveniles from inappropriate deprivation of liberty before their trials. To ask the question is to answer it. In this case, the decision to detain before trial is an important one in any criminal justice system, but it is especially important in the juvenile system. The time between arraignment and trial has been recognized by this court to be the most critical time in the trial process. Detention for juveniles, as this record amply supports, is even worse for young offenders.
Worse for young offenders.
As the record supports, it can traumatize them. I used the wrong phrase when I said offenders, young persons accused of crime. It is the needless detention. If they didn't need to be detained in the first place, it's worse for them than for adults. It's their first experience very often away from their home and loved ones. It can disrupt their school setting and their opportunity for advancement. This record shows it has done that to prejudice individuals.
Does the record show how many first offenders, or at least persons brought for the first time before the juvenile court, are detained on that basis? Yeah.
There are two kinds of record, two parts of the record that are relevant. One are the 34 case histories. Of them, 9 juveniles had never before been arrested and brought before the court. 23 of the juveniles had never had any prior adjudication whatsoever. So there is a powerful record to demonstrate that this is applied to people arrested for the first time.
Is there a report in the nature of a probation report presented before the decision is made?
Yes. There was testimony at trial by Hubert Benjamin, a probation officer of 30 years' experience, who testified that the juvenile will be interviewed for from 10 to 45 minutes prior to the initial appearance. And during that interview, the probation officer will ask the juvenile questions, including, what were you doing at the time you were arrested? What were you, what got you involved in this offense? And based on that interview, 10 to 45 minutes, make a recommendation to the court whether to parole or detain the juvenile pretrial. It has been applied countless times to juveniles who have never before been arrested, to juveniles who have never before been convicted, and as the record demonstrates, to juveniles, overwhelmingly the number of times, who are accused of only minor offenses. And detention along with adults.
When you say minor offenses, Mr. Guggenheim, can you give us some example of what you're talking
about? Yes, in the record, one example was a juvenile who was playing a game called Three Card Monte, a gambling game in violation of the New York gambling law. He was detained before trial. Another was a juvenile, as the court said.
What was the character of the New York offense which he violated?
Gambling law.
Misdemeanor?
Yes, B misdemeanor. The record also shows that 33%, New York, of course, categorizes by felony, A to E, and then misdemeanor, A and B. Misdemeanor is punishable by 1 year for A's and B's 6 months. 33% of the Vera Justice study of accused juveniles were accused, 33% of those brought on charges of B misdemeanors were detained before trial.
Now, what's the upper limit of the punishment of an adult on a B misdemeanor?
6 months.
6 months.
And your clients were detained for what crimes?
Well, my clients
refresh
is the whole class.
Refresh my recollection.
The whole class.
The named class representatives.
They were accused of more serious offenses, but they were only...
Armed robbery and what else?
One was armed robbery. One was attempted murder. But, of course, they only represent the class. The class, as the briefs clearly show, are all juveniles in the state who are eligible for detention, and all juveniles in the state who are accused of being delinquent are eligible for detention.
Well, but one wouldn't have to reach out to the unnamed class member Three Card Monte defendant to adjudicate the cases of your clients. Were they an armed robber potentially and an attempted murder?
One would not have to reach out to them to what end? The question in this case is whether this statute is constitutional.
But underlying the presentation of your case to the Second Circuit, I gather, was the assumption that there couldn't be any sort of an individualized consideration of whether this statute was applied to certain people might be constitutional and unconstitutional as to others. What's unconstitutional about applying this statute to the particular named people in this case?
Several things, but before I give an answer, I would like to point out that that's only a third or a half of the question about the case.
Why don't we try with that third or that half?
The broadest issue raised before this court is whether detaining an individual accused of even serious offenses before he or she has had a day in court, presumptively innocent, because of a belief that the individual will commit more crime if released, thereby presuming the individual's already done something wrong, violates the due process.
Now, the Second Circuit didn't answer that question.
That's right. The Second Circuit.
So why is it before this court?
It is before this court in answer to your question because it is an issue in the case which goes to this point. Even if this statute contained the kind of standards and criteria which might permit a court to detain an individual before trial, comporting with the due process clause in the Matthews and Eldridge test, the question would still remain, may a court detain an individual before trial, or is that punishment before trial?
You're saying then that because the standards may be unsuitable or perhaps unconstitutional for a three-card Monty defendant, your clients who are armed robbers and attempted murderers can't be detained under it because of some overbreadth concept?
No, with all respect, my client is the three-card Monty accused as much as to the same extent.
Who are the named parties in the case?
Martin, Rosario.
And what are they charged with?
Justice O'Connor identified those charges correctly, but they're not my only clients.
Well, you're saying that the named parties can't be held under this statute because it's unconstitutional as to a three-card Monty defendant. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying that we have proven that the appellee's class has had its rights violated under the Constitution.
Well, what rights of the named plaintiffs in this case have been violated?
Well, if this were not a class action, the question would be, could Mr. Martin challenge this statute because arguably it could be invoked or permits detention for crimes that he hasn't been accused of? I don't believe, though, that the law of class action limits the court in any way to that inquiry.
Well, but it certainly doesn't prevent us from addressing the question of the standing of the named plaintiffs to represent the rest of the class, and to at least determine, I would think you at least start out with the status of the named members of the class. The class action may be a good deal broader, but certainly you don't ignore the status of the named members of the class.
Well, I think that once
the
class has been properly certified.
Let me put the question to you another way. Your suggestion, it sounds to me, is that because a class has been certified, the court must adjudicate the statute on its face, rather than as applied to A, B, C, or D. I would think the class action certification wouldn't prevent the court from saying, well, this statute is perfectly all right as applied to the named plaintiffs. It's unconstitutional as to this lawyer's other clients.
That may be right, Justice
White.
Well,
is it right or not?
Well, my point is that the inquiry as to as applied includes the as applied in this record. It would be moot court to consider the question of whether the statute was applied fairly to Martin.
Well, we might
who's already over 16.
Well, we might come out with completely different answers as to how, as to its constitutionality as applied to the named plaintiffs and as applied to the three-card Monty plaintiff.
But both were detained under the same statute.
Well,
so I would
right.
now answer.
Well, then you're attacking the statute on its face.
And that is exactly the action
in
this case.
Well, we don't have to do that.
We don't have an overbreadth doctrine for criminal procedural statute. The overbreadth doctrine of facial attacks involve only First Amendment situations.
This isn't an overbreadth attack in the way that it is in the classic First Amendment case. This is an attack on a statute which says that depriving individuals of liberty in the absence of any standard, not because of absence of notice to the accused, but because the statute has been and can be applied inappropriately, is unconstitutional.
Well, that argument goes just as well to your clients as to the other members
yes,
of the class. I agree with that.
I can finally answer the question Justice Rehnquist put to me by saying that even the named plaintiffs have an attack, a proper attack on this statute by arguing that the absence of standards in this scheme rendered the statute unconstitutional on its face and as applied to them. But this is not an as-applied case. This record was an attempt to show, as the New York Court of Appeals agreed, although finding it constitutional, that this statute contains no criteria that would require a court to make a finding one way or another. It is up to the court's unfettered discretion each and every time. That's true for Martin,
okay,
as it's true for the three card
Martin.
But
in adjudicating the case of Martin, the court may not be required to make a finding, but makes perfectly sensible findings that he is apt to commit another crime. Now, the statute may be unconstitutional as applied to somebody else with whom different finding, respect to whom different findings. What's unconstitutional about that?
This statute contains no precisely drawn standards.
So what? What case says you have to have precisely drawn standards when you can examine the way a statute is administered on a case-by-case basis?
That leads to another infirmity in this statute. Its very existence permits the deprivation of liberty without meaningful review. Martin couldn't obtain it. The three-card Monty offender couldn't obtain it.
Martin's getting it right now.
No, I respectfully disagree. If that's the court's view, the case is moot. Martin's been convicted. He's no longer under 16. The statute is in no way capable of repetition as to him. The very nature of this case is that it is an ongoing problem.
Has he been convicted as an adult? Or
no, adjudicated, sentenced fully served, and he's now 19 years of age. And his particular facts, I respectfully submit, are not dispositive in any way respecting the broad reach of this statute or its unconstitutionality.
Well, I suggest to you that you may not want an adjudication. If all you want is an adjudication on its face, and we find that in some circumstances this statute is perfectly constitutionally applied, you lose your entire case. It just isn't unconstitutional on its face. Then I would think you would want us to say, well, it's unconstitutional as applied to other people in your class, other members of your class.
But they're part of the record in every sense.
I understand that that part of your argument certainly goes to a facial challenge, even with respect to the named plaintiffs and everybody else like them. I understand that, but we may not agree with you on that.
This statute is a textbook example of a statute without standards. Any juvenile is eligible for detention. The record shows that most juveniles detained not only were accused of minor offenses.
What if the federal government or a state, in order to implement its constitutional requirements of bail, says unreasonable bail shall not be required? Now, what kind of a standard is that?
Sometimes
you just adjudicate individual cases under that standard. Nothing. There's no standards other than reasonableness.
The question of bail is a very different one. With respect to the standards, there's an overlap. But with respect to the basis for detention, what goes to the heart of the infirmity in this scheme is that the prediction or the reason for the detention is not that someone won't return to court, which is the bail basis, but that someone will commit a crime if released. That goes to the heart of what the court has to find or presume in order to detain. We claim that this statute has no standards in several respects, but among them is that the court is not limited in a finding of substantial probability that the individual accused the offense, committed the offense of which he or she is accused, no finding of probable cause, no finding of probable conviction or sentence.
Adults as well as juveniles. To the same statute, same vagueness,
not with bail, but with preventive detention.
Yes, yes.
It is inconceivable to me, as this court said in Kent against the United States, that a court of justice dealing with adults, with respect to a similar issue, would proceed in this manner.
Well,
There is no such state.
Kent wasn't a constitutional case, was it?
No, I'm simply making the point of the language of the opinion. It was inconceivable to this court that the District of Columbia would deal with adults, that any state would, the way they dealt with juveniles. That's the argument here. Inconceivable that a state would deprive an individual of liberty on the unfettered, open-ended discretion that it can do so in this case.
Of any jurisdictions around that are considering prevention statutes for adults?
Yes, I do. But to contrast
them... What do you mean you do? You do know some?
I know of one in this district, for example. And in Hunt against Roth, although the court struggled with the meaning of the phrase, proof is evident and presumption great, in both schemes, the legislature required, as a sine qua non, that there be a finding that the individual probably committed the crime, a substantial likelihood, that it be limited to very serious offenders.
Well, wouldn't you be here making the same argument if the judge or the officer in the first instance before he could detain had to make a finding of probable cause? That's a great standard, too. You know,
well, really. Yes, it is. Yes, it is, Your Honor.
Well, wouldn't you be here making exactly the same argument? You
I may would not for this reason. The Matthews and Eldridge
well,
test...
Well, the answer is yes, you would be making the argument.
But only in this sense. It's a flexible test. What is due process? The question is the mere finding of probable cause enough? I would be here saying no.
Oh.
Add to that, limited to the Martin fact pattern, accused of attempted murder. Limited to a showing of substantial probability of ultimate placement. Clear and convincing evidence of the ultimate fact that the person is likelihood to commit a crime. Raise the standard of proof. Add them together. And I think Matthews is met, and detention is not arbitrary, assuming the second argument would be reached adversely to our case, which is that detention before trial itself is punishment for that purpose. I clearly put that argument aside to say I would be here if the only thing New York did was add probable cause. But New York not only doesn't have probable cause, it has no standard of proof. It's applied to everybody.
But it has it all very quickly, it has it.
Yes, but the limit of
very
detention
quickly.
In no wise mitigates the massive curtailment of liberty that this court finds to be at the heart of the Due Process Clause. It interferes with preparation for trial. It increases the probability of conviction. It increases the probability of ultimate placement. The record demonstrates all of those things overwhelmingly and in an undisputed way. So the mere 17-day detention is only the tip of the iceberg in its effect adverse to the person's liberty interest.
But there's no possibility of conviction here.
I'm using the word not in its technical sense. Adjudication and placement. There is no possibility of conviction. One of the other irrational aspects of this case, and I could answer this in another way, Justice Rehnquist, to the Martin and Rosario fact pattern, although I frankly think the case is much broader than that, that juveniles accused of the most serious offenses from 13 to 16 are prosecuted in New York as juvenile offenders in the adult court. For them, preventive detention may not be applied. Similarly, juveniles, persons 16 to 18, which in most states are juveniles but not in New York, are not eligible for preventive
detention. Well, the first example you give may simply vindicate your opponent's view that New York regards its parens patriae role with the children as being involved to a certain extent in the detention.
I cannot explain the irrationality of the scheme I've just described, but the record is plain from Judge Quinones to every piece of datum in this record that the purpose of this detention is singular. It is to protect the community from crime in the interim. That is its only purpose, and there's no dispute about that. Now, one of our claims in this case is that it is punishment before trial, and I would very briefly like to explain that argument. This constitutes an affirmative restraint imposed by the state for a purpose historically regarded as punishment, incapacitation. United States against Brown and Kennedy, Mendoza-Martinez, this court has plainly held that. This comes into play only because the individual is accused of wrongdoing, and it is applied to behavior which is already a crime. The state may not detain individuals before trial because of a belief that they will commit a crime in the interim before their conviction. But if they may, it is plain that any exception to the general rule that incarceration follow rather than precede adjudications of guilt can be justified, if at all, by a compelling state interest. There is none in this case. The only and lame justification for the scheme presented by the state is that the facts and reasons requirement of this statute make up for all of the absences of procedural due process protections. That requirement of facts and reasons was put into this statute by the legislature, as the Attorney General in his brief at page 36 points out, solely so that the legislature could see how the statute was operating. There is no question that there is no meaningful opportunity to review the detention decision made by the judge, even with the facts and reasons.
How about habeas?
Habeas is available as a theoretical remedy. But when a judge has before him or her a case in which the other side, the state, says, Your Honor, the statute says the court may detain when it finds a serious risk, and it has found so in this case and stated its reasons and facts on the record, that ends the inquiry. Not a single case has been uncovered by the state or by the appellees to show release of a juvenile for violation of the statute of detention when the facts and reasons were given on the record. I have litigated countless habeas corpus cases. This isn't in the record, but one does not win unless the violation was that the court said go to jail without more.
What happens in the counties outside of New York where the judge is not a juvenile court judge, he's a regular judge?
No, he is a juvenile court judge. He's sometimes what they call a three-hatter and sits as judge of three courts, but when he's sitting as juvenile court judge, that's his or her role.
Is that the judge you'd go to get you rid of habeas?
I don't know the
answer.
Against
himself? Against himself?
I doubt that, but I frankly don't know. But certainly in New York, different judges sit. But the point is, it is an illusory. And as the legislature said, we want to see in a review of the scheme, but it doesn't meaningfully protect. And Justice White is quite right. As the process moves along, the individuals in detention, that's the way it works.
Mr. Guggenheim, you made an equal protection claim below as well.
We believe as a basic point that if this court does not find that this statute violates due process of law, it almost certainly does not violate equal protection of the law. We have abandoned that claim at this time. We think the heart of our case is that this statute cannot withstand scrutiny. We think as a bottom line point, detention before trial for the purposes envisioned by this statute offend for other reasons the due process clause. It is not necessary for the court to decide this case to reach that other issue. But if it is to reach that other issue, we submit that this is a classic example of utilizing the statute in the wrong way. Most of the juveniles who are detained are ultimately released home. The vast bulk are released home, and half are never even convicted.
Is the process
that a class action was not the appropriate way to approach this problem?
Frankly, Your Honor, it is the only way to approach this problem.
Not a case by case.
There is no Article III case or controversy. I have litigated this case in different manner since 1973 in the state courts. Now, when you come into the federal court to challenge this, if you don't have a class action, your clients grow up and they grow out of the age. This isn't even a Hunt v. Roth case where you can say, well, when you're released from prison, you may ultimately be rearrested, assuming you don't get life. Here, when they're 16, they're out of the jurisdiction. It is incapable of repetition. It is only by the device of class action that we can litigate it. And the identity of the plaintiff is relevant only to the inquiry, I submit, of whether a class action is properly certified. Once it is properly certified, and in this case to be all juveniles eligible for detention, then the three-card Monty detainee is as important an example as the Martin example. We have evidence in this record that judges base their decision to detain on the political climate of the situation, of how much media attention a case gets. One judge's policy, perfectly lawful under this statute, reviewable by writ or otherwise, to detain all juveniles who are accused of an offense in which a gun was involved. That's in the record. Now, that may be lawful with a statute which has a showing of a standard of proof and a probable cause and a likelihood of conviction and other protections. This statute lacks all of the essential protections which the Constitution requires in the Due Process Clause. What is nice about this case, if I may, is that affirmance is going to improve a system of justice which this Court on numerous occasions has condemned for its failure to live up to its ultimate promise. What's wrong with juvenile justice in part, this Court has noted on many occasions, is that it fails to deter, and it often fails to rehabilitate. Every major study of juvenile justice shows, in full conformity with this record, that the vast majority of juveniles are punished, if at all, before their trial.
Could bail be required, reasonable bail be required?
Yes. New York, in its wisdom, has not imposed such a requirement, and we think, frankly, that that's sensible in many ways because there are laws.
It may be, but my question is, would it be constitutional to require bail before there's release?
I think it would be constitutional.
Reasonable bail.
Well, now you're asking me the same question as before. Is that standard itself constitutional?
No, I'm
yes,
I
reasonable
thought you were making
bail.
An argument that, bordering on an argument, you shouldn't be able to detain juveniles at all.
No, I'm not making that argument. I'm saying that this Court can comfortably affirm in the knowledge that it will result in fewer juveniles being punished before their trial, but not in fewer juveniles being detained when there is a need to show, to bring them to court for their trial when there's a risk of flight because they're eligible for detention under a statute not being charged. Since 1981, in June, this statute has been enjoined in New York, hasn't been operated. And yet, arrest statistics show that the arrest rate is down. There is no compelling state reason to justify this statute. There is a strong policy reason to overrule this statute so that juveniles will be detained in conformity with the Constitution after they've been proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt and not before. If there are no further questions, I'll stop.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted.
The Honorable Court is now adjourned until tomorrow at 10 o'clock.